Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Walmart versus Johnson.
May it please the court, Mr. Douglas Alexander will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'll demonstrate first that under any of the three exfoliation presumption rules, you can arguably applicable in this case. The Beaumont Court of Appeals majority erroneously concluded that it was proper to submit a spoliation presumption here. Second, I will go ahead and address Justice Baker's concurring opinion in the Trevino case.
Dangerous territory.
What's that? Dangerous territory, absolutely. I thought I was going to argue this to an empty chair today. I see that I'm not, so this is good.
We welcome Justice Baker back to the Walmart case.
Right. And what I will suggest delicately is that...
inevitable way.
Is that the traditional approach provides adequate safeguards so that there's no compelling reason to go to that approach, the duty breach approach. However, I will then go on and add that should this court elect to go that route, and there's plenty of sound authority for doing that, it must be said, that there's a compelling need to provide adequate limits, particularly in cases like this one in which the alleged spoliation arises before a lawsuit has been filed or there has even been a threat of a lawsuit. So those are the two areas I'll go into now. I've prepared...
It sounds like your argument is going to be somewhat different than what's presented in the brief. Is that fair
to say? I hope so, a little bit. I mean, I think it'll probably be a little bit more free-ranging, particularly on the second point. With respect to the discussion as to which way this court ought to go.
Some questions.
Yes.
Seeing beyond that, you might want to submit a post-submission.
I may want to do that, and we'll just see how it goes.
You might get interrupted.
Right. Not a problem. I've gone ahead and prepared a handout to assist me with the first task, which is suggesting that under any approach that you take, under the circumstances of this case, spoliation presumption was not called for, and I just want to quickly leap through that if I can. The first two tabs present what I would refer to as the traditional two spoliation presumption rules that applied in Texas. The first one under tab one is the deliberate spoliation of evidence rule. It's straightforward. The deliberate spoliation of evidence relevant to a case raises a presumption that the evidence would have been unfavorable. It can be rebutted by evidence that it occurred without fraudulent intent or purpose. We don't need to spend too much time on this one in this case, because there's been a concession by the plaintiffs in this case that this particular one does not apply, and I've quoted that down here below, application here.
To meet this presumption, you say that there has to be direct evidence of a deliberate destruction?
There has to be...
How do you get entitled to this? Because some evidence is there, and then it's not there.
I beg your pardon?
There's evidence, and then there's no evidence. How do you get a deliberate spoliation? How do you get entitled to that presumption under your view?
I think it would be, and again, in this case, fortunately, we have a concession that it doesn't apply, but let me try to address it. These questions end up being, and Justice Baker is correct on this point, these are legal determinations for the trial court. The trial court hears the evidence with respect to it. That is, the determination as to whether to submit the instruction at all. And what we have is a situation that, to the trial court, if there's enough of an indicia, I would say some evidence that the spoliation has been deliberate, that shifts then the burden to the party who's been accused of deliberate spoliation to bring forth evidence that it, in fact, occurred without fraudulent intent.
Mr. Alexander, I have a basic question that I think will apply to each of your theories. This is a question for the trial court to answer. At each phase, Is it a matter of the party which has the burden producing evidence or of persuading?
Producing evidence.
So once there is, at the presumption stage, once there is some evidence of a deliberate spoliation, then the burden shifts.
Correct.
And if there is some evidence that there was no fraudulent intent or purpose, then as a matter of law, the trial court must decide that there was no spoliation and no instruction is possible? Or is the trial court, once we hit the rebuttal stage, free to make the determination that it is not persuaded by the rebuttal evidence and could, in fact, then go forward with determining that that exfoliation has occurred and an instruction is appropriate?
Let me answer that question this way. In one context, not entirely clear. In another context, it is clear. And let me turn.
It seems to me that's critical.
I agree that it's critical. And that's why I want to give you a very precise answer on it. I think that the easier answer is number two. Turn to tab two, and then we'll come back to tab one. Again, I wish I had dwelled more on one. But as to tab two, the case law on this is that where you have a failure to produce, I mean, there it is, we didn't produce it, that the rebuttal is...
And that seems to be an easy burden.
It's not there. It's not there.
Right.
And the rebuttal, the approach that the courts have taken, and I'll give you some cites on this, the Texas courts have taken, is that it is a burden of production, not persuasion. And the three cases that stand for that proposition are Brewer, it's 862 Southwest 2nd at 159, and it says, all of these cases we have examined that apply this non-production presumption rule involve trial situations in which the party opposing the harmful evidence presented no evidence at all to rebut it.
Well, but let me tell you the problem I have with that. If it's just a burden of producing evidence,
right.
You have an interested witness who then gets on the witness stand and just says, here's what happened.
My dog ate.
Yeah, and the judge...
Reindeer flew away.
Exactly right. And the judge doesn't believe that.
Okay.
I mean, if it's just a burden to produce evidence, at that point in time, that's enough to eliminate spoliation and say to the trial judge, you as a matter of law cannot give an instruction to the jury. And yet I'm sitting here as the trial judge, and I no more believe that the reindeer flew away than the dog ate it.
And this is where I think it gets... You've hit the nub problem. Okay. This is where... Go back to tab one, which is the intentional. I have not seen cases that have addressed tab one, the intentional, with the rebuttal being merely production, not persuasion. Okay. It wouldn't shock my sensibilities for that one to be a persuasion element. And let's go back to your hypothetical, tab two. This is why I think the traditional scheme works now. If someone comes forward and says, no reindeer, they flew away. There it is. I produced. That's it. The judge listening to that goes, well, that's very interesting under tab two. You survived tab two. But counsel, let's go to tab one. Why would I not surmise that explanation is so far afield of anything persuasive that, by God, this was deliberate. They didn't fly away. You got rid of them.
But I wouldn't get the presumption under tab one unless there was some evidence of deliberate spoliation, which was the chief's question.
Well,
what do I have to have there?
I think that once again, you're down to the interesting question on intentional. I think that at some point we have to allow the trial court in that situation, when faced with the extreme circumstance you're talking about, which again we don't have here, fortunately. But in those circumstances, to say presumption, rebuttable presumption, that crosses the line.
It seems to me that this presents a mixed question of law and fact to the trial court, because there really is an underlying factual determination about what happened.
There is.
And if we say that there's only a burden of production and not a burden of persuasion, under tab two, and under tab one, I guess, as well, but tab two is the one that we're focusing on. If that ends up happening, we've completely eliminated that fact-finding function.
We've said
to the trial judge, you have no discretion in this matter. You're observing the witness on the witness stand.
Right.
You got to make the call whether to believe the witness or not about what happened. Similarly, under tab one, with respect to whether there was no fraudulent intent or purpose. It seems to me we have credibility at determinations at issue here, and I'm uncertain how we can eliminate including a burden to persuade at least at one or more of the stages.
Okay. I think that the appropriate way to handle it is, and let me give you those other two sites, by the way, being production, not persuasion. The other one is Bruner. It's 530 Southwest 2nd at 344. and the Middleton case, 982 Southwest 2nd at 471, all of those cases, I think, read fairly, indicate that under a Tab 2 situation, that it is production, not persuasion.
I agree
now,
with you.
Okay, now back to your point. I think that what you would have to say is under Tab 1, in other words, okay, you've rebutted Tab 2, but now if in the circumstance where the explanation is so far afield that it becomes truly evident to the trial judge sitting there, my God, this was intentional. Now, and again, and I'm not going to say it anymore, in this case we don't have it, they concede it wasn't. But I think, you know, since you're writing on the bigger canvas, I think that in the Tab 1 situation, whether it's intentional, we have to give, if the trial judge is being the gatekeeper, which is what, even under Justice Baker's analysis that the trial judge is doing, the trial judge has to be given some latitude. Has to be given some latitude to weigh credibility, to make that factual
determination. But why doesn't the trial judge need to have some latitude under your Tab 2 analysis as well? For example, if we look at looking at the totality of the circumstances here, Walmart is taking witness statements, photographs, doing all kinds of things at the same time, and yet no reindeer. And it's a $6 reindeer, so taking one off the shelf and tucking it away is no big deal.
Okay.
And so the judge looks at this, and here's the explanation. Well, we're not really sure. It may have been sold, whatever ended up happening. Logically, we think it was sold or whatever. But the trial judge, is that when it spills back over to deliberate? Because the trial judge looks at the facts and circumstances and says you're collecting evidence, but you chose not to keep the one piece that was the most critical, therefore I'm going to decide this is evidence of deliberate? I mean, or is it better to stay over in this circumstance where the trial judge has the ability to look at all the facts and circumstances and decide whether or not he or she is persuaded by the rebuttal evidence?
Personally,
it can go either place.
I agree. Personally, I believe, and again, maybe this is just being the traditionalist, this has worked fine, et cetera, et cetera, I would argue in favor of now we're tripping back over into the intentional. I mean, at some point, I mean, you're right, the persuasive element has to come in for it to have any meaning.
What if the trial judge thinks that Walmart could have done more here, that they have these huge storage centers where they buy all their product? And every time you buy something at Walmart, you get a lengthy computer list of what you've bought. But there has to be some record back somewhere of the reindeer they bought. And local Walmart stores don't just go out and buy Christmas ornaments off the street from a peddler and put them up there, and then they disappear, and there's no record of that.
Apparently, the record on this, frankly, is somewhat thin. Apparently, the only discussion you'll find in the record of that is that there was some effort to try to trace it in terms of whether there being a sale, et cetera, and that it couldn't be traced. You know, why is that? You tell me.
But if they would have inventory records where they could track the person,
I understand. What I'm saying is that in this case, the record suggests that broke down somehow, some way.
At what stage does the trial judge think about that?
Maybe the best thing to do now is to go on to Tab 3.
Is that duty?
That's duty breach. This is Justice Baker's approach. The debate, and let's talk about Tab 3, because I think this is critical. And once again, we went under Tab 3. I mean, and I'm not going to argue that, I mean, unless you want. But I lay it out here, I think, fairly clearly. And we probably will come and argue it later if you want to hear it. But the major debate, the split among the jurisdictions that we find, is those jurisdictions, and Justice Baker's analysis lays it out. There are some jurisdictions that say, look, in order for the spoliation presumption to apply, there has to be a deliberate, intentional, bad faith, you call it what you want, but essentially an intentional spoliation. Other jurisdictions have taken the approach that negligence is enough. Okay? There are, and let me try to give you the rationale on both sides, because I mean, I think that this is a court-made rule. You are free to abandon tabs 1 and 2, and to basically adopt this approach. Although I think it's important to recognize it really is different. I mean, that when you're doing it, if you consciously go that way, you say that's what we're doing, I think is really the intellectually fair way to do it. This is how it breaks down. There's two competing rationales. the Fifth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and primarily the Fifth and the Eleventh, have specifically followed the McCormick approach, which is McCormick on evidence approach. And let me just briefly give you that, because I see I've got the red light.
Please finish the thought.
Okay, here it is. This is the McCormick approach is it's got to be intentional. Negligence is not enough. It's essentially what I would call a quasi-admission approach. This is what it says. Mere negligence is not enough, for it does not sustain the inference of consciousness of a weak case. In other words, that in McCormick's mind is where that the rationale for saying it must be intentional comes from. Now, the rationale for the Justice Baker approach, and he cites this case in his concurrent opinion, is, and I think this is the best statement of it, is the Turner case. It's 142 Federal Rules Decision 68-75, Southern District of New York case. And it puts it this way. It's basically a remedial, let's level the playing field approach. It makes little difference to the party victimized by the destruction of evidence whether the act is done willfully or negligently. The adverse inference provides a necessary mechanism for restoring the evidentiary balance. The inference is adverse to the destroyer not because of any finding of moral culpability, and here's the key part, but because the risk that the evidence would have been detrimental rather than favorable should fall on the party responsible for the loss. Okay. Both competing rationale are legitimate. That's why there's a legitimate course choice for this court. Let me say this, though. If you choose to go the Justice Baker route, Turner goes on to say, and I think this is critical, and this is one point on which I really do disagree with some of the analysis that appears in Justice Baker's decision, and that is that essentially the limitation, and I'm talking about pre-litigation spoliation. The proposal that appears in Justice Baker's concurrence is that we go the national tank route, where there's reasonable anticipation of litigation. I would submit that in this context, that's a little too loose. If you look at the Turner case, it really does provide a good rationale. This is what it says. Finally, it says, look, you have to have notice. The party being charged with spoliation has to have notice as to its potential relevance.
Well,
so now that's a
that
can be
your soliloquy here.
Yes, indeed.
I think it's clear we've got two times when you can spoliate evidence.
Right.
When you don't know about litigation, or maybe three, when you can anticipate it or it's actually going on.
Right.
And so you're talking about pre-litigation spoliation, if you want to use that word.
Right.
And whether or not litigation was reasonably anticipated by the party who may have sold it, given it away,
right,
lost it, or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right.
And so you have to make that determination when it's raised by the trial court. You agree that?
I agree. The only point I'm disagreeing on is whether the standard should be reasonable anticipation. We're getting down to real nuance here. Or in the Turner case, this is the standard they use. They say, you know, the notice of the relevance can arise from a complaint being filed or discovery, and then they talk about pre-litigation. This is the standard they use. Finally, the obligation to preserve evidence even arises prior to the filing of a complaint where a party is on, here's keywords, notice that litigation is likely to be commenced.
All right, so
I think likely is a little bit higher standard.
So we said that in my concurrence, and you agree that that's a proper rule.
Okay.
Do you or don't you?
I'm back to respectfully, Your Honor.
I know.
I think that the traditional approach, tab one and two, accomplishes what needs to be accomplished.
Well, with all due respect to that, the two arguments you have in one and two are basically the Middleton arguments.
Correct.
And would you agree or disagree that basically Middleton is way past where you're arguing about that the concurrence has some difference than the, quote, traditional view, because the only discussion in Middleton is should they have submitted the instruction or not. There's no discussion whatsoever about a duty or a breach. It's all presumed that, yes, you have a duty to maintain evidence under circumstances of whether you reasonably anticipate litigation or whether it's going on. And then it just starts from there, and it doesn't go through what the concurrence talks about. So I frankly think that the case you rely on, which is Middleton, is assumes everything that the concurrence says and goes from there. Because all it talks about is what kind of a evidence was there put on to show that it wasn't either negligence or what it was reasonably anticipated or not. And one of the things it talks about is that they didn't testify about it, which is what your tab one on the intentional. Granted, this evidence in this record shows there was testimony about the reindeer by both sides, and there was sharp disagreement. But some of the things you've left out, for instance, if you want to say the issue here is whether Walmart could reasonably anticipate there was going to be a claim because the man said he wasn't hurt. The other side says, well, but when Walmart was asked about where are the yellow pad records that the manager took down the very day and talked to the injured party, where are they? Walmart objected on the grounds that you're not going to get them because they were made in anticipation of litigation. Seems to me that there's a reasonable presumption by the trial court if you say a piece of document that you made on the same day that the person was injured can't be produced because it was made in anticipation of litigation. A trial court could have been justified in saying, well, if you don't have the reindeer, it's for the same purpose, and say, I think that they're entitled to it. So the whole argument is, should they have given that instruction under the record in this case, as opposed to a dichotomy between a traditional review and whatever the concurrence is? That's what my view is.
Okay. I think that...
And you know where I'm going to come out, maybe, by that.
I'm guessing. I'm just guessing. I
am concerned about the fact that when you rely on Middleton, it was decided about 3 months after we issued Trevino.
Right.
And so maybe the court that handled that case, I forgot who it was now.
I think it was San Antonio.
The San Antonio court had been reading the advance sheets or something. But it never even says anything about it.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, what has happened in the wake of Trevino is that we've got some courts, and we may be in disagreement on this. I think that there really is a distinction between what I would call the traditional approach and what appears in your concurrence. I think that both approaches are legitimate. I think they're different. And I think that in writing...
You don't think a trial court decides when this issue comes up, well, did that party have a duty, this mental process, to keep this piece of evidence? And if so, what does it arise out of? Well, we got clear background in our jurisprudence that, yes, parties do have a duty to maintain evidence that may be pertinent to future litigation, but only under limited circumstances. And I'm not saying when your people say, well, we sold them all, isn't a legitimate statement. But I also can say that under the full record is the trial court's discretion, isn't it, to determine whether to submit an instruction or not and whether it will help the jury under the circumstances. And that's the approach the Middleton case takes, and it went back and forth. And so I suggest that you go back and forth on the record in this case, tell us how we can find that there was an abuse of discretion.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can answer that. And again, I think that, I mean, if the court... Whichever way the court goes, and there's legitimate grounds to go either way. I mean, one of the things that I would tackle is the intentional versus negligent split. There really is a split. I mean, are we going to go the Fifth Circuit route, or are we going to go with, what Turner is saying? You can go either way, but I think that there need to be limits. And one of them I suggest is the likely versus reasonably anticipated. Now, getting back to your question, let's take a snapshot, and I will get to the facts on this one. Let's take a snapshot of what occurred when we talk about duty on the day of this accident. And the majority does not recognize this. Reindeer fall off shelf. Walmart people come up and say, what do we have here? They do this in any case, even if there's a remote possibility of any complaint downstream, as well they should. Not a reasonable anticipation, I mean, just a remote possibility. This is what they do. Fellow says, I got a cut on my arm, okay? clean with peroxide and a Band-Aid. No stitches. Now, what we're talking about here, you have to be on notice of the relevance of the reindeer. Now, that's all he complains about on the day of the incident. Now, what does he ultimately recover? He recovers a jury award awarding $45,000 in hard medicals. What the heck were those? Was that to sew up the arm? No. It was because he had a pre-existing neck condition.
Well, I can understand you could argue that to the jury.
Well, what I'm saying is, I mean, this is the key. This is the, okay, this is where we may have a disagreement. What I suggest is because, and you'll get this from the cases when you wade into them, because the instruction itself is so inflammatory, in marginal cases of dubious merits, what ends up happening, and this is the concern as to why you shouldn't just willy-nilly submit it, the case turns from being a case on the merits to being a case on is Walmart or Kmart or whoever it is. I guess we don't have Kmart anymore. They've gone south. We drove them into the ground. But the for which I feel bad. But the you know what the, in that circumstance, what ends up happening is that's what the trial becomes. It becomes all about that, and that is why it is critical, I believe, for the gatekeeper role of the trial judge to be clearly defined. I don't think it's easy to just say let's just get that to the jury because the problem is it's so nudgy.
We've already said we're not going to give that to.
Okay, well, I thought I heard you different.
No.
Okay.
We all agree that it's a question of law whether whether there's going to be...
Okay, then I misheard. Then I misheard.
Instruction or not.
Okay. But getting back to the facts, and getting, you know, in this circumstance, what we have is, what we were supposed to anticipate was...
Let me get back to my question.
Okay.
How can we hold the trial court abused its discretion under this record in submitting that instruction?
We can hold it because under the undisputed facts in this case, whether we go to your standard of reasonable anticipation or fall short on that is litigation
likely.
Well,
what standard do you want to have?
I want to have the traditional approach, but let's say let's go with your standard.
What is the standard to decide that this question exists in the first place?
Well, then let me answer this way. Let's assume that we take your approach. Under your approach,
so
I'm advocating...
My question first. What is the premise that you take in the first place to assume the problem exists?
The premise you take is evidence which has now, years later, suddenly become relevant, even though it wasn't at the time of the accident, is gone. That's the premise. That's the problem. But what you have to do is you have to go back and take a snapshot on the day. Here we've got... Let's assume that he sued for his arm.
Is there any dispute by Walmart that this man was hit by one or more reindeer?
No. There is no dispute, and the beauty of that is
there's no dispute that when it comes time for discovery, there are no reindeer to be found.
No dispute.
And the other side says, we think that's bad business, Judge, because that's what hit us, that's what caused our injury. And we think they did it on purpose.
And this is, let me answer this point. If the man comes back and sues for the only thing he complains about on the day of the incident, that is a cut on the arm, we don't have the reindeer, but he goes, there's no dispute. He was hit by the reindeer, he got the cut, let's give him his $10 in damages. When he comes back years later and says, I want $45,000
for... But you haven't complained about that.
What's that?
You haven't complained about an excessive verdict.
No, I'm not. I'm just talking. What I'm talking about is relevance. I'm complaining about the relevance. In other words, what we're supposed to anticipate is that this guy was going to come into court years later and say, you know, the problem isn't the cut on my arm that you know about. It is that I've gone and seen this doctor in Louisiana that's done all this surgery on my neck, and so now there's an issue as to what the composition of the reindeer was. That's the relevance. Well, did we know? Were we on notice? And look at Turner, on notice of the relevance on the day of the incident? No way. No way. There's no way going back to that day to go, oh my God, we should have anticipated that he'd be coming in complaining about his neck.
So that's your answer then?
Yes.
That there's no knowledge.
Correct. There's no notice of the relevance.
No notice or knowledge of anticipation.
Correct.
By Walmart that this was going to be the issue.
That is correct. Okay, and then with respect to the anticipation of litigation admission thing that they want to talk all about, I think it's laid out in the brief adequately. I mean, essentially on that is you have a broad question that would create a continuing duty to produce any statements produced up until the time of trial for which a general objection is made that this is, what was the objection? Anticipation of litigation. But with respect to the thing that was actually created on the date we produce it, in other words, I think it's really inappropriate to try to extrapolate from the answer to that interrogatory an admission that on the day of the accident there's an anticipation of litigation. Looking at the full circumstances fairly.
I understand your position. Thanks for answering the question.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Sparks, will present an argument to respond.
Please, court.
Morning.
What Walmart is suggesting concerns me. They've changed their arguments a bit today, but in the briefs to this court, they first say the trial court has no authority, none, to remedy pre-litigation spoliation. That is devastating.
I don't read their arguments.
Sir?
I don't read their arguments quite that broadly.
That was in their appellate briefs to this court.
They concede that you can always remedy pre-litigation intentional spoliation.
Your Honor,
I asked Mr. Alexander in light of this if he wasn't changing the argument from what the briefs were, and he said he was. So.
Okay. Well, then let's look at the second thing that concerns me next to that one is that what Justice Hankinson talked about, which was all it is a burden of production. Is that all Walmart has to do is to find a manager or an employee to come in, like they did in this case, and say, here's what he said, they would have been sold. He did not say they were sold. He did not say, here's the inventory documentation to show you where these reindeer are. He speculated.
And let's assume that's very troublesome. And it's equally troublesome to have the other side come in and say, well, they're gone. There must be some fault here. How do we resolve that? I mean, it doesn't seem to me it'd be a good idea to do it either way, to say plaintiff shows up and says, well, some of it's missing, so they must be at fault. Charge the jury. The other side says, oh, no, it's bound to be an innocent mistake. Don't charge the jury. How do we get that resolved?
The trial court resolves that, Your Honor.
Well, how?
He can't just
flip a coin. What does he do?
Yes, sir, and I understand it. And again, we responded to in our brief that Walmart seems to think that there's some rule of law that this court can write today or tomorrow, whenever the opinion's written, that will forever in the future tell trial courts how to handle spoliation. That's not what Trevino says. Trevino says it's an evolving remedy, evolving sanctions, issued under wide, broad discretion. So what you do is you entrust it to the trial court.
They have to have a standard. You almost said, okay, Mr. Plaintiff, give me three reasons why I should charge the jury. Mr. Defendant, give me three reasons why I should. What are those reasons?
Well, the reasons that we submitted in this particular case is we pointed out the fact that on the day of this accident, they did considerable investigative activity. Phyllis McClain, the store manager, she interviewed the Johnsons and took down notes on a legal pad. We've already talked about what happened to those notes.
Why isn't that spoliation?
Well, Your Honor, the reason we didn't shoot after that is because the reindeer to us, I mean, that was pretty central to the case because we're saying they're wooden, they're saying they're paper mache. That's pretty damaging for their employees to come in and a string of employees to come in and say, these were just paper mache reindeer. So obviously the reindeer to us seemed to be where to go after on the spoliation charge.
Which you could claim throwing the notes away was spoliation.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that's what's troublesome is, you know, sometimes you just throw things away because you don't keep everything in the world.
That's right.
And how do we distinguish those?
Well, Your Honor, you keep showing the facts and circumstances, and you show that also they photographed Mr. Johnson's bleeding arm.
But what standard is the trial court to measure this evidence against in order to determine whether or not a spoliation instruction is proper? Mr. Alexander says he recommends that we do the standards that are contained in tabs 1 and 2 of his oral argument exhibit, and then the other option is what is contained at tab 3. I know you've got this whole record of evidence, but what standard should the trial judge have measured that evidence against, and then how should it be reviewed on appeal?
Your Honor, obviously we're relying heavily on the second tab, which is the negligent exfoliation of evidence. The third tab, or the failure, he calls it the failure to produce.
Right.
And there's been a mix of semantics, apparently, where at first they were arguing there is no such thing as negligent exfoliation. And now we're at, okay, now maybe there is negligent exfoliation.
Well, tell us from what, if you were writing this opinion and you had to start off by saying, here's the standard that trial courts should follow in weighing all the facts and circumstances and deciding, what would the standard look like? How would you write the opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. The Bruner and Brewer opinions offer that standard. Even the Middleton opinion offers it. It's the non-production of relevant evidence within a party's control raises the presumption that that evidence, were it produced, would operate against that party. And every intendment will be in favor of the opposite party.
It seems like this is going to have a very profound effect on all sides of all dockets, because there's going to be plenty of injured plaintiffs who threw away the clothing or the bandages or whatever. There are going to be businesses in fraud cases who threw away documents. And whether you're plaintiff, defendant, intervener, whoever you are, you're going to be faced with the accusation that if you didn't keep everything, there's a presumption it would have hurt you.
That may be the accusation, Your Honor, but that's why there's an abuse of discretion standard imposed upon the trial court.
If the evidence is not produced, then must the trial court give the spoliation instruction?
No, ma'am. Not at all. The trial court is free to reject the suggestion.
On what basis? That's what we keep asking.
Okay, and it's under the same standard that I just showed, Your Honors, and it's what you talked about with Walmart just a second ago, is what do they offer to rebut the presumption? And you look at that, and you say, is that a reasonable explanation, even the middle
case?
Okay,
so are you then primarily looking on a failure to produce case like tab number two, except you would impose a duty to a burden of persuasion as opposed to just production?
Absolutely. That the burden of production frightens me, Your Honor.
I know, but then is the test actually what's laid out in tab two of the oral argument exhibit?
Well, tab two, no,
there,
ma'am.
That you would just have to show the failure to produce, which is what you just said, and that would give rise to the presumption. And then they would rebut with a reasonable explanation, but would have a burden to persuade the trial judge that explanation was acceptable.
That's correct.
So it basically is what's at tab two, except you would change it from a burden to produce to a burden to persuade.
That's correct. And in the second box, if you insert reasonable in front of the word offer and before the word testimony, and then at the end of that box put to the trial judge, then you would have what I consider to be the proper, the law to say that it's always good.
It would seem to me that in any retail context where there's an inventory and display to the public, there's always the risk that the display will fall over and injure somebody. And these are just products that are for the display to be sold. It seems to me that if the product, if there was no threshold showing that the product was segregated and put away and was supposed to be in storage and then all of a sudden it shows up missing, then it would seem to me the evidence coming forward on what happened to it could be no better than what Walmart has here. Well, it was sold in the regular course of business. But your argument would be that this would not be sufficient to rebut the presumption such that the trial court could give a spoliation instruction here.
That's
we
correct.
There's no indication that these reindeer were ever pulled off, ever segregated, anything. I don't know how in every context where material falls off a shelf, somebody ultimately comes along and sues for injury as a result of that, that any retailer could ever avoid the spoliation instruction. Because their evidence could never be better than it was sold in the regular course of business, the best we can tell.
I mean, the rule exists, Your Honor, to level the evidentiary playing field. And what they came into court with was a customer incident report where their employee wrote down, customer says he wasn't hurt, and blurry photographs of the reindeer. Now, what Walmart is not, or continues to say is irrelevant, is they also lost their pictures of my client's bleeding arm.
Well, but the instruction itself does put a bit of a thumb on the scale, because it's something from the court that pretty much says, here's what you are to do. I mean, and it's a practical matter, without this instruction, it would have been the plaintiff's word against the defendant's word, and the good plaintiff's lawyer is going to say, and the only person who could have brought it here was you, Walmart, and you didn't. So, as a practical matter, the jury's going to probably hold that against the person who didn't produce the evidence in the swearing match anyway. So here, a spoliation instruction is not, I mean, it really does put the thumb on the scale a bit. So it's a pretty, it's a pretty effective or overwhelming sort of remedy for mere non-production.
I would say effective, Your Honor, not necessarily overwhelming.
Well, again, it seems like effective to me would be how it's played out in the trial court as a practical matter. It is a bit of an uphill battle if the court instructs the jury on a spoliation point.
I agree with that.
And because of that, then, shouldn't we have a higher threshold at the beginning on deliberate conduct, that there must be some evidence of deliberate conduct as we start with under tab 1?
That, and tab 1, incidentally, Your Honor, I don't know how, as a plaintiff's lawyer, I'm supposed to prove tab 1.
Well, then, that's a point, too.
I mean, I guess I have to take a six-hour deposition of a Walmart manager and hope and pray that I get him to finally admit that, yeah, he spoliated those reindeer. And I'm pretty young, but I doubt I'll ever do that in my lifetime.
You agree, don't you, that there are retailers who prepare incident reports when really there is no anticipation of litigation. For example, the customer bumps into a display, incident report is prepared, and the customer says, "I'm fine, nothing. You know, I'm. Don't worry about it. Thanks for all your help," and leaves. In that scenario, would the retailer be required to preserve that evidence for a period of 2 years, whatever they bumped into?
Not in the isolation, in that particular context, as you're just giving me, no, sir, I don't think that it would be appropriate for a trial judge, just based upon that, to say, okay, now you get a spoliation presumption.
Well, let's say, I mean, in this case, if we hold that the spoliation instruction was proper, what, don't you think that's what retailers would then do? I mean, in every case, it's going to be, there's going to be the Walmart warehouse in 35, and then the other warehouse with all these, you know, manner of things that customers have bumped into over the years.
Well, there already is a warehouse. That's where they kept the pictures of the blurry reindeer, and presumably that's where...
But would there be required preservation any time there's an incident report, for example?
No, sir.
Why not?
Just for an incident report, no, sir.
Why not?
Because that, in those particular facts and circumstances, in my opinion, if there's just an incident report, customer's not bleeding, there's no one out there taking down, interviewing witnesses and photographing evidence, if all that is not present and there's just an incident report for the customer bumping his head, then frankly, I think it may be an abuse of discretion for a trial judge to say that there entitles a presumption.
It doesn't seem to me to be very hard to argue. I would represent the plaintiff. I would say she went down and wrote down what had happened. She obviously talked with her manager after that. He said, don't put that in the report. Put this and this and this in the report. Say this happened. She did all of that, typed it up, threw away her original notes, and if we'd had her notes, we could show that this accident report was not accurate. It was fabricated, and we don't. And so please charge the jury on spoliation. And it seems to me that's a fairly logical argument that you could make in many cases. But if you could do that, you know, those arguments will cut all different directions and run the risk of turning the trial into a trial on who was the worst spoliator rather than who caused the accident.
Well,
go ahead and answer this question. I thought you were taking a pass on it.
The risk of my clients, you know, spoliating, it's not so. I don't think my clients drive around. Take a car wreck client of mine. When they have a car accident, they don't have a Polaroid camera in their glove box with an accident investigation report and three people in the back seat that are almost guaranteed to show up in trial and support them. So in that instance, if they go and get their car fixed without taking a photograph, I will tell them, now since the car is fixed and we have no evidence of your damages, the judge, in his discretion, may be able to instruct that, hey, you fixed your bumper, you've done spoliated the evidence. But I will also advise them that I feel, in my opinion, that would be an abuse of his discretion.
Why?
Because in the facts, particularly...
Because he argues 9 months later, no, I didn't. The reason I got the bumper fixed was because I didn't think I was hurt that bad. But you know, months later, weeks later, I realized, oh, no, I'm much more seriously hurt than that. But now you're facing a trial judge who's going to tell the jury, well, if he fixed his bumper, he probably wasn't hurt.
Well, see, and again, Your Honor, I disagree with that respectfully. I don't understand why Walmart continues to pound my client's medical condition. That has nothing to, and like I said in the brief, I don't understand what that has to do with spoliation at all, because spoliation is an evidentiary presumption. They levied the same arguments to the jury, and the jury rejected those medical causation arguments that they levied.
I'm just trying to think about a retailer, a grocery store. How many slip and fall cases come through there a week, a month? And where do you put all that evidence, and how long do you save it? When you don't think there's a serious injury or claims in it, don't you think the severity of the injury has something to do with that?
I do feel the severity of injury, which is precisely why I keep pointing out that my client was bleeding in their store, and they were photographing the bleeding arm. Yes, sir.
There's a submission here. The trial judge's submission in this case has a factual element about whether Walmart knew or should have known that this might be evidence in the courtroom. Do you think that part of spoliation should be left as a fact question, and the trial judge decide everything else?
I feel like the rebuttable or rebuttal should be left to the trial court as a rule of law, and knew or should have known is a fact question for the jury.
If we disagree with you and determine that the trial court did abuse its discretion in submitting the instruction, was the submission of that instruction harmful error?
Again, and Walmart does a good job of pointing out that paints me in a bit of a box. I will concede that the reindeer were critical evidence. I will not concede, as Walmart suggests in their briefs, that our closing argument was...
I think the severity of the injury has something to do with that?
I do feel the severity of injury. This is precisely why I keep pointing out that my client was bleeding in their store and they were photographing the bleeding arm. Yes, sir.
There's a submission here. The trial judge's submission in this case has a factual element about whether Walmart knew or should have known that this might be evidence in the courtroom. Do you think that part of spoliation should be left as a fact question, and the trial judge decide everything else?
I feel like the rebuttable or rebuttal should be left to the trial court as a rule of law, and knew or should have known is a fact question for the jury.
If we disagree with you and determine that the trial court did abuse its discretion in submitting the instruction, was the submission of that instruction harmful error?
Again, Walmart does a good job of pointing out that paints me in a bit of a box. I will concede that the reindeer were critical evidence. I will not concede, as Walmart suggests in their briefs, that our closing argument was all about spoliation. Our closing argument was a walk through the charge, a walk through the medical testimony, and briefly about spoliation. And then at the end of the closing argument, we said the reindeer are not as important as Walmart's trying to make it.
Well, let me ask you a question on that. The weight of that reindeer is critical to your client's recovery for the neck injury, isn't it?
It's not.
Your doctor could get up there and say, well, you know, it was papier-mâché. That still caused this injury. So is that basically how the case goes? Even if it's made of papier-mâché, you still have your evidence of causation.
And in all candor, Dr. Gunderson did testify to that the reaction to the falling reindeer could have caused him to pop his neck.
So why did you need the spoliation instruction?
Because I had two employees coming in. I think it's inflammatory to come in and say, you know what, this guy's faking it. It's papier-mâché reindeer. And that's what they did. They brought in the deposition testimony of the little employee who pushed him over. He admitted he never picked them up. He admitted he didn't know how much they weighed. But gosh darn it, they were papier-mâché. Second, they brought in the store manager, who based upon an interview with that gentleman 1 week later, speculated and concluded on that speculation that, oh yeah, those were papier-mâché. So when I'm faced with that, Your Honor, I'm put at a disadvantage because I've got a jury back there saying these are papier-mâché reindeer. Despite Dr. Gunderson's testimony, who undoubtedly on very good cross-examination will admit he's being paid for his time. Despite Dr. Gunderson's testimony, guys, these were papier-mâché reindeer. They couldn't have caused his arm to bleed. So I need help in that situation, Your Honor.
You say arm to bleed, but that really wasn't what this case was about, is it?
Well, I think, no, sir, it's not. Absolutely.
It was about the arm bled. You were having to convince the jury that these deer, it was the weight of these, that these deer were heavier than what Walmart said they were. You felt it was critical to convince them of that. Because they were saying they were made out of papier-mâché. Your doctor said that papier-mâché reindeer can cause this injury. You were concerned that if the jury believed Walmart that they were papier-mâché, they would disbelieve the doctor's causation testimony and conclude that he wasn't injured like the doctor said he was.
I feel like they would disbelieve anything once they're told that these were papier-mâché reindeer. I can't, as a reasonable person, say that a papier-mâché hitting me in the head is gonna cause me to have a neck injury of this magnitude.
Really, you saw that this case really was going to come down to whether or not you could get a spoliation instruction.
No, Your Honor, no. I saw this case as a case where Walmart came in with all the damaging evidence and none of the evidence all the evidence that helped them and none of the damaging evidence. And I felt like I was at a disadvantage. And the trial court imposed the least sanction it could and gave the jury an instruction on spoliation that they could have freely rejected.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I have 5 points for rebuttal. Let's see how many I can get through. We'll start with Justice Hankinson's question about burden to persuade or burden to produce. One of the things I want to stress is that that question is an important question, but it is academic in terms of how this case comes out. In other words, when I said that it's produce, not persuade, I'm saying that is what the precedent has been. I'm not saying it's outcome determinative. In other words, should this court decide that it's a burden to persuade, under that standard, we win, nonetheless. There should not have been a spoliation instruction, and I wanted to make that point. Now, should the court elect to go the persuade route, and I can see the arguments in favor of that, I think it would be fair to go ahead and overrule these other cases, Middleton, Bruner, Brewer, because, I mean, they really do make it clear that it's produced, which this court is free to do. I mean, the Court of Appeals decision. So that's point one. Point two, where am I backpedaling from the brief, Justice Phillips? I think that and this may be the point you're getting at. I think in the brief, the argument was made that you cannot have a spoliation presumption arise from pre-litigation conduct. The problem I had when I started reading all the cases and inherited this file very recently was when I read the Bruner case, which concerns the onion, you know, and in which case, you know, remember the smashed on onion. Anyway, what you need to do is look at Bruner.
Well, the brief also took Walmart's version of the facts. Pretty much established as a matter of law. I suppose the trial judge and the jury did feel that way.
Okay, well, I might have guessed as to where we were backpedaling from, but anyway, I did want to make that point, is that with respect to whether under the traditional rule it can relate to pre-litigation, if you read the Bruner case, you almost have to conclude that it can. Point three is here the reindeer are only critical if Walmart on the day of the incidents could have looked into a crystal ball and foreseen that they were going to be sued for this man coming in and saying, I had a pre-existing neck condition. When you read the record, that will come screaming through. And that's a critical point here, because I will submit to you that there was nothing that would give rise to that sort of crystal ball foreseen on the day of the accident. The only thing was a cut on the arm. Well, everyone agreed that the reindeer caused a cut on the arm. Again, if there was a suit for the $10 for the cut on the arm, you don't even need the reindeer. What is the composition matter? Everybody agrees there it is. They've got a photograph of it. I mean, even the degree of the injury is done. So it's only pertinent with respect to the issue of should they have foreseen that there was going to be a suit for the injury to the neck? And the answer to that question has to be no on this record. Now, this goes to the next point, is the evidence harmful?
And it's an abuse of discretion for a trial judge to think otherwise.
Correct. Correct. That's the standard.
But it seems to me you define that so narrowly. We talk in many cases that people are on notice when they have a legal injury, although they may not know the extent of the injury.
That's statute of limitations.
But you seem to be trying to narrow and say because it was a cut on the arm and everybody could see it, that made the reindeer not relevant to the neck injury. But I could see that some infection happens to the arm, so that the obviousness of it's not obvious how serious this injury is several days later after the reindeer is sold. I mean, you're trying to argue that we have to be on notice of a particular injury in order to determine whether that's relevant. And it doesn't count that we know the reindeer caused an injury. It's not, we don't have to keep it unless we know it. There's some real serious injury that got caused. And if we don't know that real seriousness of an injury, we don't have to keep the reindeer. It seems to me you can't parse it that closely.
Well, let me try to parse it as close as we can, because I think it's critical, getting back to Justice Heck's point, we have to have very clear standards. And that is getting to Justice O'Neill's point, the thumb on the scale. Let there be no doubt that the submission of a spoliation presumption puts the thumbs on the scale. And for that reason, it is critical that we define under what circumstances you can have the presumption, particularly when there has been no suit filed and no threat of a suit.
So the bar does not find the Trevino majority to be helpful.
I beg your pardon?
The bar does not find our majority in Trevino to be helpful.
Well, the majority or Justice Baker's concurrence?
The other eight.
Well, I don't think that it provides us guidance on this issue. I mean, and this is an important issue as to what the standard should be. So getting back to the point, when you're talking about pre-suits, that's why I'm saying it is critical to define the standard.
Your time is up, but you're only to number four. Would you give us four and five real quick?
I will. Well, five was thumb on the scales. I hit far.
Who was
five.
Four?
Four is it harmful evidence? Look at record volume 3, page 188, plaintiff's counsel, the composition of the reindeer is the most critical, quote-unquote, piece of evidence in the trial. It's harmful. Well, let's see if I hit everything else. I did. I'm done.
Well, when we talk about the thumb on the scale,
yes.
That kind of idea tends to make one think that this kind of instruction would always be harmful error.
I'd say that, and I haven't thought about it, I'd say that in most cases it probably would, simply because it is so inflammatory. You can maybe hypothecate a case in which the evidence we're talking about is so marginal in the case that it doesn't matter. But I mean, but the sense you get from reading the cases is when the trial shifts from the merits to chunk, 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 where are these people hiding the ball? You know, don't you know that if there's, you know, that they would have kept those reindeer under circumstances, blah, blah, blah. When it shifts to that, it is inflammatory.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one more. But looking at the harmful error point, Mr. Sparks says to us that the employees of Walmart got on and repeatedly said it was papier-mâché, no big deal.
And the incident report said that, too.
And the incident report said that, and right. So he finds himself in a position of having to deal with that evidence and rebut it at trial.
Correct.
So why does it become a thumb on the scale if, in fact, in response to it, it's just it's the response to it's papier-mâché? I can't answer it because I don't have the reindeer anymore because they did not preserve it.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because it turns from being a swearing match what we were left with in this case was the classic swearing match under circumstances where there was a reasonable explanation for the reindeer not being there as to what were they composed of, which was relevant because he had the neck injury, and yes, I do hammer on that. That was a swearing match between the plaintiff, as we see in all cases. One party saying they're wood, another party saying that they're papier-mâché. The way it tilts the scales is, once you bring in the court and put in the jury charge, aha, look at this. I mean, read the closing arguments. They say they didn't hammer on it.
Thank you.
Decide for yourself.
That concludes the argument for today. The marshal is adjourned to court.